Care Talk. In today's episode, we are talking with Dr. Safiq Khan, an Assistant Cooperative Extension Specialist in Water and Watershed Sciences with the University of California Division of Agriculture and Natural Resources, and an Assistant Adjunct Professor in Civil and Environmental Engineering at UC Merced. He is the director of the Forest Ecohydrology and Water Systems Lab at UC Merced, which focuses on understanding watershed processes under a changing environment and climate. He is leading cutting-edge research on developing alternative forest management and land use solutions for building water and watershed resilience. So Safiq is a wonderful person for us to talk to right now because we've all got snowpack on our minds, or many of us have snowpack on our minds. And Safiq really has a ton of expertise thinking about the Sierra snowpack, thinking about how best to manage it, and thinking about these interactions between snow and vegetation and water and fire. So we're really excited to kind of talk with him and also just do some Sierra snowpack 101 kind of general, get some general information about the Sierra snowpack. A lot of people have been talking about how rare or unique of a year this is for snowpack, but you know, it's also nice to just have some intuition to understand what's happening right now. So it's really great to talk to Safiq, and he's also just a wonderful colleague in UC Extension. We've all known Safiq for a long time. He's kind of a leader in the water community across the UC system. He is one of the leaders of our like water program team, which is our network of water scientists throughout California. So he's really been a wonderful person to just know within the UC system. And I think we all really enjoy talking with and working with Safiq. So Sam Faith, what do you think about talking about snow and talking to Safiq today?
Yeah, I think like you, Malika, I'm always happy to talk to a good colleague. I do feel like Safiq is definitely one of our most collegial and generous colleagues. And I am really grateful to him and Ellen Bruno for all the work that they do just coordinating water across UC Cooperative Extension. And it is obviously a great year to talk with Safiq about the snowpack and the concerns that people have about lowland flooding over what really is probably going to be the next couple months to even what sounds like a couple of years in terms of water in Tulare Lake. So yeah, it's a great time to talk with Safiq.
Not only a leader on the specific title, but also a leader in terms of a service, bringing people together and being able to empower others. So I think that's something that Safiq has helped us out. One other thing that truly Water Talk will go from the headwaters to the ocean. I mean, we've been talking about water and focus quite a lot on use or cities. Now we're going to the headwaters and understanding some of the processes. I like also to have this podcast to be one of the 101s while everyone is talking about a snowpack. In this case, it will be good to have a good refresher on a snowpack in the Sierra, the importance. And I think he also brings a long-term perspective from what used to happen to what is likely to happen due to climate change. So I'm really looking forward to talk with him.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm super interested. And I guess I'm curious, maybe Sam, Faith, like one question that I had, and I guess we can also ask Safiq, but a question that I was thinking of as I was thinking of like what to talk to Safiq about is of the snowpack in California, the Sierras are not the only place that there's snow, but they seem to be the most significant component of California's snowpack. But I was curious if either of you kind of had any sense of like how it compared to other parts of California where there is also a snowpack. Like, is the Sierra snowpack like 90% of California's snowpack, you know?
Yeah, definitely we should talk with him. I mean, there is some snowpack in the San Bernardino Mountains, the Tehachapis, and so on. But yeah, the bulk of the snow, it's in the Sierras.
Yeah, I mean, my sense is definitely that the snow that supplies water to the most people in California primarily comes from the Sierra. And so even though you do get fairly significant snow on, say, Mount Shasta, that also will melt over the summer, it doesn't supply nearly as much drinking water to nearly as many people. And so I think it's both the biggest source of fresh water from snowpack in California, and it provides water to the most people. So yeah, I definitely say it's important.
For our listeners outside of California, because I've been noticing you listeners outside of California, you're starting to grow. So for those of you who are listening outside of California, one of the things that was kind of surprising to me was just starting to think about the snow as, like Faith, you were mentioning, as like a reservoir in and of itself for water. And I just watched Sam give an extension talk a couple of days ago. And that was one of the things you said too, Sam, just you talk about snow in a different way than I grew up thinking about snow.
And I think we're going to also cross at another topic that might be of interest for what is coming, the fire season. And we're going to be talking about Sierra and fires. And it will also go through some of the now cultural practices, indigenous cultural practices that we are trying to implement again. And what have been the impact of not doing it in the past. So Safiq definitely is crossing a lot of the different topics that we have discussed from a Headwaters perspective.
Absolutely. So without further ado, let's talk with Safiq. Welcome to Water Talk, Safiq. We're glad to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you have some really cool interests in montane watersheds, forests, and snow hydrology. Can you tell us a little bit about what your path was like getting into this type of work?
I kind of took a very unusual path. And this is simply because I grew up in a very rural part of India. I had no idea in terms of research career or, you know, going abroad, to be honest with you. So I was basically helping out my family with a lot of, you know, the farming activity day to day, kind of, you know, making sure that things are taken care of. My dad was a, you know, primary school teacher, so he was pretty much always out, and I was the only one at home. So I was kind of juggling between my own education and taking care of, you know, the family. Doing that, I think, you know, I had this natural kind of fascination towards nature, right? Just kind of seeing plants, seeing soil, seeing water kind of flowing in the landscape, you know, and that part of India gets flooded quite frequently. So, you know, we saw that the flooding was kind of like an adventure, right? Every year, you wait for the flooding to get out in the flood and just have fun, right? And so I had the natural curiosity, but I would admit that, you know, growing up in India, and many kids, you know, who grew up in India during my time in the 80s and 90s, we had no luxury of picking your career, right? We tried our best, and then we just grabbed the opportunity, whatever came in our way, right? So I basically got, you know, after trying several years, you know, for the engineering, I finally got into the ag engineering program, and then try to make use of that and kind of align my interest, what I was fascinated with, and then, you know, make that program actually fit. So, you know, water came naturally to me, but I was mostly focused towards the on-farm, you know, type of work, right? So you probably don't know this, but my master's thesis was actually looking at earthworm activity in rice field and how the dual porosity or macro porosity that earthworms actually create impacts water and solute transport.
Wow. I would have guessed that. That's awesome.
Right. So that's the scale I was looking at. But then, you know, I kind of felt like that was just too small of a scale. And I was more interested into something that, you know, where a scale over which your science can be applicable to management.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I basically, during my grad school, I started looking at more watershed scale processes. So that was in Hawaii. Again, you know, I landed in Hawaii.
I know. Right? That's a piece of luck.
That's a piece of luck, right? and And basically, there is no snow in Hawaii unless you go to the, you know, the Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa. So the snow hydrology was not part of my, you know, training, other than just reading in the textbook. So I really kind of started paying attention to snow and snow hydrology when I started my postdoc back in 2010 at Oregon State. So that was my first exposure. So I consider myself a newbie when it comes to snow hydrology. It's been only 14 years.
You've obviously done a lot in that time.
You know, if you're thrown in the water, you just learn how to swim, I guess.
So, I mean, the Sierra snowpack is a large component of the all the work that you do related with watershed management in the headwaters. So what better year to have a Sierra Snowpack Hydrology 101 than this year? So can you help us and help our audience to let us know how the snowpack works in California and why and how this year is unique?
Yeah, so the way I really look at the snowpack, and this is what really fascinates me, the snowpack is really a nature's gift to us. And the reason I say that, because if you think globally, before we dive into California, there are about 8 billion people, and over a billion people, actually, out of those 8 billion, rely on snowpack for their freshwater supply. So the snow, even though it's not always in front of our eyes, it plays a big part in making sure that people have access to safe and clean drinking water for both, you know, our use as well as, you know, for food and everything that we need water for. Coming back to here in in California and Western U.S. in general, I mean, about 60 million people actually rely on mountain snowpack for their freshwater supply, right? So it plays a really big part in our day-to-day life, even though we don't really think about it. Just to give, you know, some more numbers to you, in California, we get about 100 million acre feet of precipitation every year on average. And depending whether you have a, you know, wet year or dry year, anywhere between a quarter to half of that precipitation falls as snow. So there's a big variation from year to year, but that's quite significant. That's a lot of water that we get, you know, in the form of snowpack. And the reason I said early on that this is nature's gift to us, because this is a natural storage. Because of this Mediterranean climate that we live in, we don't really get precipitation or rainfall at the time when we need it the most. So imagine a life in California without snowpack. So just the sheer magnitude of the snowpack water supply that we get and we are blessed with, imagining life without snow in California, it's just like, it's hard to like even comprehend, right? And I want people to actually really pay close attention in terms of what is happening to our snowpack. I feel like there's a lot of discussion on, you know, the groundwater depletion and subsidence and everything that really comes with that, which is well justified, but I think people really need to pay attention what is happening to our mountain snowpack, because that is the natural reservoir that we really pay nothing to keep that reservoir running. But it provides, you know, I think anywhere, like if you just look at the Sierra snowpack, it varies from, you know, 3 million acre feet in a really hot 2014 type of year to as much as 33 million acre feet of water in the snowpack, and which is the same magnitude. I think our agriculture water use is about 30, 35 million acre feet a year. So it's a lot of water we are talking here, right?
And Safiq, I mean, in this year, so I typically go and have a download a snowpack on April 1st and then compare it throughout the different years. And for instance, I noticed 2011 was a wet year. 2017 was the wettest, but when you compare them head to head, actually the snowpack was less. And now in 2023, it is a larger footprint. So why this year is unique, or how can you tell us what is the difference between this year and other years in terms of a snowpack?
California is a very big state when you think in terms of the latitude-wide, right? So even when you get on average, you know, the statewide, let's say a year like 2011 and 2017, that doesn't mean that it's a good year for a snowpack. Because if you think of the state's climate as you go towards the higher latitude from south to north, things get colder, right? Because you're gaining, latitude. So precipitation increases as you go from south to north, but you lose altitude. So Northern California, the elevation is much lower than, let's say, southern central and southern Sierra. So the amount of snowpack increases as you go from north to south, but precip increases as you go from south to north. So, and the reason I'm saying this, because it really matters when it comes to the atmospheric rivers that hit California. So it really depends not only from where they are originating in the Pacific, but also where they land, where they have the landfall, right? So imagine an atmospheric river hitting close to the central and southern Sierra, where the elevation is pretty high. So a lot of that precip, the moisture will, get pushed by the mountains, right? So you get a lot more of that precip falling as snow. But if that, atmospheric river moves northward and hits, let's say, northern coast, or southern Oregon, then because of that, the lower altitude, a lot of that precip will fall as rain. So you ask what is unique in terms of this year. If you think like all the atmospheric rivers that came this year, a lot of them actually hit, between November through March, a lot of them actually hit in the central coast. So that was kind of a sweet spot when it comes to, maximizing our snowpack storage. So precip-wise, I totally agree that this year is not the extreme, especially when you look at the Northern California and the Northern Sierra. But the snowpack is pretty intense, simply because it just happened that a lot of the atmospheric rivers hit the coast, which was really the sweet spot when it came to the snowpack accumulation. Hopefully this gives you a larger perspective in terms of multiple factors and controls when it comes to the snowpack accumulation in the state.
So one question, Safiq, that's like not on the list, but was just a question that came up that we were wondering is, with all of the snow that potentially falls in the Sierra, there's like snowpack in other parts of this state. And it seems like the Sierra snowpack is definitely the most significant snowpack in California. How does it compare? Is it like 90% of the whole snowpack that we get? Like, when you think of Shasta or you think of some of the other places in California where there is snow?
Yeah, I would probably say like, close to 90% if I have to just throw a number. And this is basically my guess. And the reason I say that because on average, I think just the Sierra alone, the peak snowpack is about 16 million acre feet, right? And if you look at the statewide, on average, the total precip that falls as snow is about, 20, 22 million acre feet. So when it comes to really the snowpack, it's all about the Sierra. The Northern California does get some snowfall depending on the year, but a lot of those snow doesn't really last very long unless you are on Shasta side of things, right? Because most of that snow really falls and then it melts within very short period of time.
Right. Are there any rules to be considered part of the snowpack in terms of when the snow falls? If it melts in a few days, is like, oh, that's not the snowpack. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so the snowpack is I think people have used, because the snow falls and then it melts depending, what happens between the storms, right? And the question that people often ask is really the amount of precip that falls as snow is relevant for water supply, or is the amount of snow that you have accumulated over a long period of time is really relevant? And it really depends, whether you're talking about, water supply for downstream uses. Then I would probably say it really doesn't matter what happens on event by event basis, but really how much total you have accumulated over the entire season. Because by the time you start kind of, preparing the farm and all type of, the use cases, I think it's really the April, May, June, that's the melt season that really dictates, all right? But the earlier melt, that's also relevant for the ecosystem, right? Imagine, if you get really intense rainfall, a lot of that rain will not infiltrate into the soil and it probably run off, right? So, but instead, if you get that perceived as snow, and if the snow, you know, sits there, and even if it melts over a week, that's going to be a very slow melt. So a lot of that water actually recharges the soil. It provides, you know, the water for the habitat. So I wouldn't really say that this short-lived snow is not relevant for us. It's relevant for the ecosystem.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. No, thanks for clearing that up. I'm just kind of getting all my snow questions out right now.
Yeah, these are very good questions. These are all nuanced questions. Yeah.
So I guess this kind of brings us to this idea, because we have on Water Talk, we actually did another Sierra episode, but we talked to Dr. Joan Dudney out at UC Santa Barbara, and we focused on the forests, you know, and we just talked about forests and forest health. And we didn't actually talk too much about snow, but there is this connection, right? So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the relationship between the snow hydrology and then the forest vegetation that's in the Sierras.
Yeah. So thanks for bringing that up. And it just happened that, you know, one of my, you know, PhD student just this morning got his first paper accepted looking at the relationship between the snow and the forest vegetation. Because I did the same thing, right? Every time when we talk about snow, we talk about the downstream interest. We don't really talk about the role of snow in shaping or reshaping the mountain vegetation. So it's really, really important, even if the snow is going to last there for a week. But just kind of thinking broadly, I think the vegetation and snow, they have somewhat this love-hate relationship. And the reason I say this, because if you have a lot of snow on the ground, it's really good for the vegetation because that's the water that is kind of stored there. Otherwise, the water would have run off and not accessible by the trees. So if the snow sits there and melts during the peak growing season, the trees can actually tap onto that, you know, resource and do what the trees are supposed to do. So they really benefit. Otherwise, imagine like, you know, in the peak summer with no rainfall, you know, how these trees actually going to survive this 4 or 5 months long summer drought. The snowpack is really a critical component of our forest ecosystem. Without the snowpack, I think you already kind of got the glimpse of what the future might look like during the drought when you had this massive tree mortality. And a lot of that was actually driven by the lack of snow on the ground, right? So yes, we had lower precipitation overall, but not having the snow actually amplifies the impact because you don't really have whatever precip you got, the storage wasn't there. It just, you know, ran off. So the snow helps the forest basically grow and accumulate more biomass. But then what happens, you know, when you have this dense vegetation, that really lowers the snow accumulation, right? So they're kind of fighting. I think the nature is fighting in itself. So the snow, you may have heard that the snow does a lot of good things other than providing water. It really suppresses the ground vegetation. It can actually thin the forest from the snow loading. So it's really trying to create these patchy areas where the snow can actually accumulate. And then the trees basically provide the shading and make sure that whatever snow that is on the ground stays long enough and kind of, you know, hidden in this micro, you know, climate. So they're kind of, you know, protecting each other, but at the same time, you know, they're having this feedback between the snow and vegetation, right? It's really a nice nexus between these two processes that are feeding off of each other.
Hey, Safiq, just a follow-up question. So at the beginning, you mentioned that about 100 million acre feet falls, and then half or a quarter may end up as snow. So what happened with the other half or three quarters? Is it just evaporated or taken by the forest and send it back into the atmosphere?
No, let me clarify that. Okay. So what I was implying that on average here in California, we get about 100 million acre feet of total precipitation. Out of that 100 million acre feet, anywhere between 25 to 50 million acre feet of that precip falls as snow. So the rest would be rainfall. In terms of the total water that is available, you know, for runoff, it's anywhere between 40 to 45 million acre feet. So the half of that total precip actually gets used by the vegetation. So that's basically your interception, transpiration, and, you know, sublimation and all the other fluxes that return back to the atmosphere.
Safiq, this leads nicely into the next question. So it's still snowing in the Sierra, right? But of course, people are already worried about fire season because, you know, we're always slightly worried about fire season at all times in California. So can you talk a little bit just about what the snowpack might mean for fire season in California this year?
Yeah. So I think, you know, yeah. So the previous question was really kind of, you know, feeding into this one. And as I was saying that the snow plays this dual role where it's really in a good year like this, you know, you will actually, if you go and hike in the Sierra this year, you will see way too many trees, you know, half broken, you know, from the snow loading. So the snow basically does this thinning of the forest without us, you know, having to take the sha and machete and trying to, you know, clear the field. So it's doing the work for us. So that's one thing. The second thing is when you have snow sitting on the ground, and the ground fuel is literally covered, right? So it's not accessible and it's probably not ready to be burned, right? So it really shortens the wildfire season, especially in a year like this. I mean, we are already in May and we are just beginning, and at least we started the melt season, but then got pushed into this cold front, right? So we are yet to see the peak melt, and we are already in May, right? So if you have a good year in terms of the snowpack, it can really lower the window over which you get most of the wildfires. So the snow can not only, you know, lower the ladder fuel, it can also keep the ground, you know, fuel moisture wet for a longer period of time. And that really reduces, you know, both the likelihood of, you know, having a fire. But even if you get a fire, a lot of these, what do you call these micro climate, you know, micro refugia, where you may still have snow or wet ground that would really not let the fire get out of control. So the relationship between the snowpack and wildfire is well established. And this is really, as a scientist and as someone who really cares about our, you know, headwaters, kind of imagining a future without snow in the Sierra is very frightening. Because if you don't have snow, and our precip pretty much kind of stops in March, you know, I mean, you get few storms here and there in years, but the peak of the wet season is from November to March. So imagine a dry, hot summer from April all the way to October, right? That's a very long summer hot window. And I can't really see how we can, you know, go and manually fight these wildfires without snow helping us.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that I have been telling people is that that's definitely the case in the Sierra, but, you know, in sort of lower lying areas, particularly, you know, grasslands and chaparral systems, that we still, you know, need to worry about fire season, particularly as there's been so much precipitation and vegetation growth due to how much rain we've had. So, yeah. And then I was just curious, when you brought up the issue of the sort of downed trees, I was almost expecting you to then say that those would become more accessible fuel, but you're really talking about it from the perspective of thinning, essentially. And so I'm just wondering if you know, when you think about that, you know, because the trees aren't necessarily being taken out at that point, are they? They're sitting there to essentially become fuel.
Yeah, you're right that they will eventually become, you know, a ground fuel. But at least, you know, we don't have the same level of ladder fuel. I think the problem in the Sierra is really if you get a fire and the fire burns on the ground, I'm not too concerned, as long as it's not threatening life and property. The problem is really these situations where the fire basically leaves the ground and reaches the top of the canopy, and ladder fuels play a big part in that, right? So we're not really fixing the whole wildfire problem, but at least, you know, the snow is helping us at least in one aspect of that wildfire puzzle, I guess. And you're absolutely right. I know, I think, you know, every time when we say that the snow and how the snow reduces the wildfire window, the years when you have higher snowpack tend to be wetter years, and with a lot of moisture coming in, we also do a lot of fuel buildup in non-snowy, you know, regions, as you were saying, right? These foothills, you know, Southern California, Coast Range. And if you have a lot of these grasses and shrubs, you know, kind of accumulating all that biomass. So that's, yeah, that's a, you know, other side of the story. So wet season, good for water supply, not so good if you happen to be in this lower, mid elevation where you don't really have the protection from the snow when it comes to wildfire.
That's really tricky. That's just so complex. I mean, it's hard. It's very mind-bending to think about that. So, kind of back, I guess, to the frame of thinking of snowpack as being great for water supply, what are some of the strategies for enhancing snowpack that for years that are not like 2023? Like, and what resources might be needed to put these strategies into place?
Yeah. So as I was explaining earlier, right, you need enough opening in the forest where the snow can accumulate, but not big of an opening where that snow is really exposed to the sun. Because in that situation, even if you get a lot of accumulation, that snow will melt rather quickly. So it's not really very useful for us when it comes to water supply for downstream users, right? So now the question really is, how can we create these patches where, we can accumulate above average, let's say, snowpack, right? And this seems to be tricky. There's been a lot of research on this topic into what's the right size of opening. And as you can imagine, there are way too many factors that really dictate that, right? So it not only depends where you are, relative to the equator, because the sun angle plays a big role. Then it also how tall the trees are, because again, the solar radiation, if it's hitting straight, then probably the height of the tree doesn't really play that much. But if it comes at an angle, then how much shade you're going to get on the snow depends on the length of the trees. And then you have the slope of the landscape, you have the aspect, whether you are a north-facing aspect or south-facing aspect. So a lot of these really, factors that drive the water and energy budget really dictate what's the right size of opening we should create. So it's very nuanced. And I think what we really need is really a basically landscape-based prescription. We cannot really create something, statewide that, hey, this is how you go about doing it, because it's just so localized, right? So the prescription needs to be localized, as well. Otherwise, you may end up creating these large gaps that instead of doing good, they will end up actually harming the snowpack. And I'm going to say this, but it's going to be controversial, right? A lot of the focus right now when it comes to managing our forest for wildfire is driven by really this fuel reduction, right? I think everybody is so much focused that let's get the fuel out of the forest. My really fear there is that if we take this wildfire view when it comes to managing forest and do not really pay attention in terms of how is that going to change the hydrology, in particular the snow hydrology, then we might create a different kind of problem, both in terms of you will not get the same level of protection, the wildfire protection that you were getting, right, when the snow was, right, if the snow is not lasting long enough. And plus, you're going to jeopardize the water supply for the downstream users. So what I'm really arguing that we really need to take a more holistic view of our headwater management. Yes, wildfire is on top of everyone's mind, and that's probably the biggest issue that we are facing. But how can we create a prescription that is looking at multiple aspects of the ecosystem? So it looks at the habitat, it looks at the fuel, it looks at the water supply, and not just the water quantity, but also water quality. Because if you open a big canopy and you have a lot more snow accumulating, and then all of that snow melting in really short window, then you might create water quality, issues because of the erosion and stuff. So how can you take a more holistic view when it comes to our headwater management? So I don't know we are really taking this view. So that's why I said it's going to be pretty controversial, because it's all driven by wildfire risk reduction.
And, other people that we have interviewed, Erica Guys and others, they always talk about this systems perspective rather than problem perspective. And it is good to remember that, if we need to take a look at the system as a whole. Safiq, you've been talking about fires, snow, forest, but we're missing our rivers. And so could you tell us about how does it look, a headwater stream, and why are they important?
Yeah, so every time when you hear the word headwater stream, I don't think there's a clear definition that what is considered a headwater stream. And the way I look at it, anything above the dam, I consider that, you know, headwaters. Even though pretty much some of the rivers and streams, even above the rim dams, they're also dammed, right? But if you take a much broader view, I think, you know, every time when you say headwater stream, I think in your head, you're thinking of first order or second order stream, all right? These are small tributaries that really kind of, that's where the runoff begins. It starts accumulating and, you know, channelizing, right? So that's what we call the headwater stream. And I'm glad that you asked this question, because every time when you think of a river or a stream, that's not where your mind actually goes, right? You think of Sacramento River, you think of, you know, Mississippi River, or, you know, Colorado River. But if you add all the river length, 80 to 90% of the river length or stream length, whatever you call that, those are the first and second order streams. So just the sheer amount of their footprint is pretty big compared to these, you know, big rivers that we often think of. And the reason I'm saying that is because thinking of, you know, the ecological implication of that, right? So a lot of these small, you know, streams, they're really critical, especially in the Western US where you have this Mediterranean climate, right? So if you imagine, if you don't have the base flow in these headwater streams, what would the species that really rely on those streams for their water needs, right? I mean, California is one of the biodiverse state in the US, and many of those species rely on these small tributaries for their survival over this prolonged summer drought.
And Safiq, I'm really glad that you mentioned that. I mean, water is not created on the reservoirs, right? And the importance of all the protecting all the headwater rivers. Not sure if I typically call them the water factories when we have that snow and coming into there. So yeah, the habitat that they have there, good habitat.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say that. And a lot of these small, like the first, second order streams, they're really sourced from snowmelt. Because at that level, you don't really have a lot of base flow. It's really the snow, the late season snowmelt that is kind of, you know, trickling down and keeping those streams alive. And the reason I'm bringing this up, because imagine, you know, a future where you don't have the snowpack. A lot of these streams will actually be dead and dry, right? And just the ecological implication of a no snow future in these headwater streams is going to be a disaster, right? So again, you know, I think we often get selfish when we say that, you know, the snow for water supply, but we mean that the snow for water supply for us. But the ecosystem, even when those streams are just trickling, you know, that their ecological implication is pretty big. So again, another reason why we really need to protect our snowpack.
I've never heard the term no snow future, and it is kind of a scary term. Is that a real concern? Is a no snow future something that we should be thinking about? It's here. Okay.
It's already here. It's already here in this like this mid elevation where the precipice constantly shifts between rain and snow. A lot of those regions really don't see snow in most years, right? So a lot of those, you know, the smaller streams were basically sourced by the snowmelt, and California is in particular is very sensitive when it comes to this mid elevation, what we describe as rain snow transition zone. Because of this, just the steep topography, right? And a lot of these, the northern, as we were discussing earlier, the northern part of California, there is pretty low lying, you know, areas where the snow falls. And if, even just, you know, a half or 1 degree, you know, temperature warming will really kind of remove all of that snowpack, right? So it's already here. It's just, you know, because it's right now it's in this, just this transitional snow zone. that is, we're probably not, you know, paying attention. And that elevation over which you get the seasonal snowpack is really moving upward. And there's evidence of that. You see like the global, you know, trend or even local trend in the snow covered areas that's getting, you know, smaller and smaller. So we're not talking about the next 50 years. The no snow future is already here. It's just a matter of, you know, finding where these, you know, places are.
So Safiq, you've already obviously touched a little bit on the effects of climate change directly on the snowpack. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about just climate change in the Sierra in general, how it'll affect, you know, watersheds maybe headwater streams, or just, you know, any thoughts you have about the changing climate in the Sierra.
Yeah. So I think we talked about a lot in terms of the role of climate in shaping the Sierra snowpack. And it's pretty obvious what we have seen in the last 10, 15 years, right? The direction in which we are heading. And again, I don't want to dismiss the year like 2023. We will keep getting years like 2023. But in between, you will have these other type of years, the other extreme, right? And I don't think it's really good, right? Either way, because it's very difficult to manage extremes. Right. But the other side of the climate aspect, right, the vegetation, for example, right, if you do not have the snowpack and if the vegetation has to solely rely on the soil moisture and the subsurface storage in the Sierra, that's just not enough to keep the vegetation alive for that, you know, 5-6 months of summer drought. So in a warmer climate, a lot of the vegetation will actually die, and we are starting to see the signal of that. So that's just the vegetation, you know, itself. And the implication of that dead trees basically means that some other type of species will take over, right? The species that are more resilient to drought, and oftentimes they tend to be non-native species, right? Because the native species, the climate has, you know, passed beyond their climate, you know, range, right? So that might, you know, bring more invasive species. And if we try to keep the same vegetation there, I don't think they can survive given the competition with the other type of vegetation that are more equipped to drier and hotter climate. And then, like, you know, and then you have also, you know, we talked about the wildfire, right? So with the wildfire playing into that, the vegetation, you know, water feedback, you know, kind of what you call, like, you know, some people like to describe that, you know, double whammy, right? The drought is killing tree, and then the wildfire is basically, you know, turning them into ashes. And then the other type of feedback, right? When you get wildfire, the wildfire will reduce the snowpack even further, because the snow, you know, the white snow basically reflects the light. And as soon as you start getting this ash and, you know, char, you know, sitting on the snow, it changes the color, which changes the albedo, that really, you know, starts the melt process even faster. So everything is connected to everything else, and the feedback is pretty fascinating, right? So I don't know. I think, you know, like when it comes to just thinking of headwaters, I think, you know, our climate future is pretty kind of, I don't want to use the word like depressing, but it's really kind of, you know, if anything we learned in this kind of the previous episodes of the drought, I feel like that is really the future we are headed to if we don't take any proactive action. I think, you know, still we can make amends, and we can start to do things differently and make sure that our ecosystem is better prepared to cope with a future, you know, warmer and drier climate. Otherwise, I think, you know, this cycle of, you know, drought, tree mortality, wildfire, this feedback will just continue.
Well, Safiq, we always like to ask our guests if there's anything more that you want people to know about your work and how we can all support your efforts.
Yeah, so I really, you know, through this forum, I want people to pay attention to their surrounding and see what is happening, and take ownership, even if you really have no direct connection, so to speak, or no direct reliance when it comes to water or other type of natural resources. Because if it's not today, tomorrow you will be impacted. So pay attention what is happening in your, you know, headwaters. See what land managers are doing and making sure that their They're not focused based on their agency mission only. Make sure that they are looking at the system as a whole. So, you know, if we are going to continue to manage our forest, make sure that we are not only mitigating wildfire risk, but we are also creating a future that is more resilient. That is this, a future that is more resilient for our water supply, a future that is more resilient for our ecosystem, you know, species, you know, and, you know, trees and all type of life that actually, you know, thrive on those. So all I wanted really to get involved and stay informed and be loud and vocal about, you know, if something you do not like, you know, register your opposition and make sure that the people who are doing those things, they hear your concerns. Otherwise, I think if you don't look at, you know, these lot of these issues, then, you know, I think at some point, the same way that, you know, the wildfire suppression, you know, came in and now we are facing the consequences, something else will get created and then our, you know, kids and grandkids will face the consequences. So just become an informed and active citizen of the state.
Thank you so much for joining us today and giving us so much food for thought and I guess food for melt.
I like that, food for melt, yes.
Thank you for listening to the Water Talk podcast. My name is Samuel Sandoval. I'm a professor and cooperative extension specialist at UC Davis.
I'm Faith Kearns with the California Institute for Water Resources in the UC Division of Ag and Natural Resources.
I'm Malika Noko, an assistant professor of soil plant water relations and irrigation management at the University of California, Davis. If you enjoy our show, please review, listen, like, and subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts. Find transcripts and additional content at watertalkpodcast.com. Original music by Paloma Herrera Thomas.